know if they're recording, so I can get started. Okay, everything's going strong. Okay, well, as you know, the last week I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the anti-imperialist tradition in America. And I put a few articles on the syllabus to read. The one by Joseph Stromberg, I think, is very good, a very good summary of the anti-imperialist viewpoint in American history, imperialism, non-interventionism, and revolution, opponents of the modern American empire. Stromberg is famous, at least among those of us who study these things, as being a voluminous reader and writer. You look at his articles, dozens and dozens of references, and he speaks authoritatively about all of the references, too. So I thought I'd put that article. It's kind of long, but it's well worth pursuing as far as that goes. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. And I think I'll start off with reminding everyone of the view of Jefferson and George Washington of military interventionism that I mentioned in the first week of the class. And George Washington once said that we should have with foreign countries as little political connection as possible, trade with them, travel there, but have as little political connection as possible. And then Thomas Jefferson, in his first inaugural address, called for this: peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none. And that was the essence of American foreign policy, at least in theory, at the beginning of the American Republic. And it was never perfectly practiced, but a majority of the public, I would argue, agreed with that viewpoint. And then there's the famous statement by John Quincy Adams this was his 4th of July speech that he made in 1821, where he said this, I'm quoting, America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is a champion and vindicator only of her own. She will recommend the general cause by the countenance of her voice and the benignant sympathy of her example. She well knows that by once enlisting under the other banners than her own, were they even the banners of foreign independence, she would involve herself beyond the power of extrication in all the wars of interest and intrigue, of individual avarice, envy, and ambition, which assume the colors and usurp the standards of freedom. The fundamental maxims of her policy would insensibly change from liberty to force. That was John Quincy Adams in 1821. And so that was the original mainstream thinking in the early American Republic. And like I said, it never was perfect. There was agitation for conquest and imperialism during the War of 1812, but still these were the reigning ideas. And of course, there were always the development of opposing ideas. The Monroe Doctrine came 2 years later, 1823, which pretty much announced that that the United States would engage in Western Hemisphere hegemony. This is our hemisphere. And so non-interventionism pretty much prevails until throughout the 19th century, with the exceptions of, we did mention the Mexican War was a war of conquest or imperialism. I argue that the American Civil War was also, but we really fell off the cliff in terms of imperialism with the Spanish-American War. And so then another idea, of course, that was invented was manifest destiny. And then, it's our destiny to essentially rule the world. And then American exceptionalism, which we've talked about also, the idea that Americans have some sort of unique ethical superiority over other people, which somehow gives us a right to govern them. And so these were some of the ideas that were developed, along with a truly evil idea right around the turn of the century, 1899, the year 1900, was the open door policy. And this was basically the announcement that the United States government would use whatever means possible, including military means, to allow American business people to trade and do business in other countries, although that door would not be open in America to other countries necessarily. So this was at a time when we had very high protectionist tariffs. The average tariff rate in the United States during the American Civil War went up to 45% to 50% range. Before the Civil War, it was around 15% on average, 1.5. But it stayed in the 50% range until the income tax came into being in 1913. And so here we are with hyper-protectionist trade policies, making it very difficult, if not impossible, for foreign businessmen to come into America and do business. So we announced very arrogantly, or the U.S. government announced very arrogantly, that it expected an open door toward American businesses, that is, free trade toward American businesses. I guess that's the sort of thing you can do when you have more guns than anyone else. And so these are just sort of a quick overview of what I think are some of the main ideas that were brought about to start whittling away at the Jeffersonian, Washingtonian, John Quincy Adams idea of non-intervention that did prevail in the minds of most of Americans, I think, in the up through the 19th century. And among the first anti-war protesters in a very serious way were the New England Federalists, New Englanders, and they held a secession convention in Hartford, Connecticut, in the year 1814. And one of the reasons for this was their opposition to the War of 1812. There were other reasons for this convention. They hated the embargo that Jefferson and Madison enforced, the trade embargo that Jefferson brought into being because he thought the British were kidnapping American sailors and stealing American ships to assist themselves with their war with France. And rather than go to war again with England, Jefferson imposed the trade embargo. And of course, in New Englanders, most of the trade across the Atlantic took place from New England and New York. And so they were very much opposed to this. And they were very much opposed to Jefferson in general. And so, but the War of 1812 was a very important reason why they nearly seceded in the year 1814, New England did. Long before Abe Lincoln and the Southern Confederates came into being, decades and decades before that. For example, let me read a few of the things. Once the war was declared, once the War of 1812 was declared, listen to what Governor George Morris of New York said. He said about the war. He said, "We are to be taxed beyond our means and subjected to military conscription." He said, we cannot exist but in poverty and contempt without foreign commerce as a result of the war. He thought the war would cut off foreign commerce. And he said, and by a war of any continuance with Great Britain, that commerce will be annihilated. So the governor of New York denounced the war. There were dozens of town meetings all over New England. The Massachusetts legislature formally declared the war to be, quote, needless and unwise. And then they said that, and they encouraged citizens to not volunteer for the militia to go to the war. They said this was the Massachusetts legislature, let there be no volunteers except for defensive war. And so they discouraged people from participating, and people who did become conscripts, there were incidents of the Massachusetts government putting them into debtors' prison temporarily while the enforcers of conscription were in town. And then as soon as the enforcers would leave, the men would be let out of debtors' prison. And, of course, they weren't actually debtors. The Supreme Court of Massachusetts and Connecticut ruled that states had a right to decide whether such thing exigencies existed that warranted calling up the militia to participate in a war. This was back when states' rights or federalism was still alive, before the Lincoln administration had destroyed it. Okay, and so the War of 1812, the New Englanders essentially seceded from the Union during the War of 1812 by not participating. The country was at war with England, and New Englanders effectively seceded from the Union by not participating in it. And so the New England Federalists were the first big anti-war proponents that I think are worth mentioning here in the American tradition. I also mentioned in my little letter to the class on the chat a few articles, and some of you are probably familiar with Lysander Spooner, and in his one of his books is entitled No Treason, and there's an essay in there about the Civil War, the American Civil War, and Spooner was very much against it. Now, Spooner was a famous abolitionist for decades before the Civil War. He wrote a book called The Unconstitutionality of Slavery, which made the case for the peaceful abolition of slavery on constitutional grounds. He also wrote a handbook on jury nullification, instructing northern states on how to go about legally nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act and the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution. And so Spooner was a lawyer and a philosopher. And he actually carried on a correspondence with William Seward, the American Secretary of State during the Lincoln administration, and with such people as Senator Charles Sumner, a senator from Massachusetts during that time. And let me give you, and so he was stirring up anti-war sentiment, and he was doing all sorts, everything he could to get people to join in with him to oppose the war, although it's hard to oppose a government that has an income tax and is able to use the revenues of money printing and income taxation to enforce conscription, which Lincoln did for the first time ever in the federal government. But here's one of the things that Spooner said in his letter to Charles Sumner, and he excoriated Sumner and all the Republicans, Lincoln included, because Sumner had said that he thought that Lysander Spooner's arguments that slavery was unconstitutional and that route should be taken, like all the rest of the world had taken the route of peaceful emancipation. Only here in the United States was there a war that was associated with the ending of slavery in the 19th century. And he said, Sumner, well, why then in heaven's name do you not take that position, that is, the constitutional route? He says this, had all those men at the North who believed these ideas to be true, that is the unconstitutionality of slavery, promulgated them as was their plain and obvious duty to do so, it is reasonable to suppose that we should long since have had freedom, that is the ending of slavery, without shedding one drop of blood. The South could consistently and with honor and probably would have, long before this time and without a conflict, without a war, have surrendered their slavery to the demand of the Constitution and to the moral sentiment of the world. You, meaning Sumner, and others like you have done more according to your abilities to prevent the peaceful abolition of slavery than any other men in the nation. And he went on to say that the war was being fought for what he called, quote, the lenders of blood money who had for a long series of years previous to the war been willing accomplices of the slaveholders in perverting the government for the purpose of liberty and justice. And so he thought it was a war about the economic domination of the South, and it wasn't a war of humanitarianism, as the standard account goes. He said, the Lincoln government did not go to war for any love of liberty or justice, but for the control of the Southern markets through tariff extortion. And so this is the sort of thing that Lysander Spooner, the famous libertarian abolitionist from Massachusetts, who was a contemporary of Lincoln, said to Senator Charles Sumner. And so this was quite the deal, quite the speech. And I just lost my chat and everything again, like I did last week. Oh boy. I have no idea what happened. Another big secret about the Civil War, and I'm just looking at the screen to make sure I'm still good, is that there was a massive desertion crisis. And so there were a lot of secret societies that were started to oppose the American Civil War in the northern states and in the South. And so the one book that I've recommended in the chat, I think is very interesting in this regard, is by Ella Lawn, and it's called Desertion During the Civil War. I think it was first written in the 1920s, and then it was reprinted more recently. But here are some of the things that Ella Lawn said in this book, and the book is all entirely based on the official records of the War of the Rebellion, which is the official name of the Civil War that the government gave it. In addition to writing about all the secret organizations in the northern states, she writes also about massive desertions. For example, here's what she writes. Although General McClellan had 180,000 men on his official roster prior to the Battle of Antietam, he had no more than 90,000 during the battle itself. So about half of the entire Army of the Potomac deserted on the eve of the Battle of Antietam in Maryland. General Sherman reported 70,000 men missing during the Battle of Shiloh, 70,000 deserters. In June of 1862, General Buell reported from Tennessee that 14,000 officers and soldiers were absent from his command. When General Hooker took command of the Army of the Potomac in January of 1863, Ella Lawn writes this, desertions were occurring at the rate of several hundred a day. About 25% of his army was absent, according to the official records. And according to the official records, Ella Lawn points out, there were 100,000 deserters from the Union Army in 1862 alone. And when General Hooker took control of the army, he found that 2,923 commissioned officers were missing, along with 82,188 non-commissioned officers and privates. And so this was a massive anti-war statement, hundreds of thousands of men fleeing and deserting. And so that's why by 1863, the Lincoln administration adopted a policy of shooting or hanging deserters, and they finally achieved sort of Nazi-like efficiency in the execution of deserters. Here's what Ella Lawn writes, how she describes what was apparently a daily occurrence in the U.S. Army after 1863. A gallows and shooting ground were provided in each corps, and scarcely a Friday passed during the winter of 1863-1864 that some wretched deserter did not suffer the death penalty in the Army of the Potomac. The death penalty was so unsparingly used that executions were almost daily occurrences in most of the armies. Soldiers were forced to watch these daily executions of their friends and comrades in the form of an official ceremony. The condemned men marched out between the two ranks of the regiment, preceded by the musicians playing a funeral march. The provost guard, as an escort, carried the coffin. The victim was conducted to the edge of the grave, which had already been dug. After the sentence was read, he was seated, blindfolded, and placed upon a board at the foot of the open coffin, into which he fell backwards when the firing squad had discharged its sad duty. This method of execution was generally shooting, or the method of execution was generally shooting, but hanging seems to have been used occasionally, end quote, writes Professor Ella Lawn. And so this is what happened to the deserters. This is how the desertion crisis was dealt with by the Lincoln administration. Another aspect of American history is that there were draft riots in the United States during the Civil War, and I guess the most widely cited book is by Ivor Bernstein, The New York City Draft Riots. But there's also, I've also in some of my work, have quoted a little book by Arthur B. Freemantle, and the book is called 3 Months in the Southern States. Now, if any of you happen to have ever seen the movie Gettysburg, it was, 15, 20 years ago it was made, movie Gettysburg, part of the movie, which is an extremely accurate portrayal of the famous Battle of Gettysburg in the United States, there was this little British soldier guy who was following around Robert E. Lee's army. He was just hanging out and asking questions. This was Colonel Arthur B. Freemantle of the Cold Spring Guard. He's a British soldier who was there as an observer. And so he spent 3 months traveling with Robert E. Lee's army, including a witness to the Battle of Gettysburg. And when he got back home to England, he wrote a book called 3 Months in the Southern States. And he just happened to be passing through New York City during the New York City draft riots. This was after the U.S. government began enforcing military conscription, and there were riots in the streets in New York City. And so Lincoln sent 15,000 troops from the Battle of Gettysburg, which had just concluded, to New York City, and they shot into the crowds and killed hundreds, maybe thousands of draft protesters. Here's what Fremantle wrote, Arthur Fremantle. In his words, the reports of outrages, hangings, and murder were now most alarming. The terror and anxiety were universal. All shops were shut. All carriages and buses had ceased running. No colored man or woman was visible or safe in the streets or even in his own dwelling. Telegraphs were cut and railroad tracks torn up. The draft was suspended, and the mob evidently had the upper hand. The people who can't pay $300 naturally hate being forced to fight in order to liberate the very race who they are most anxious should be slaves. So what Fremantle is saying is that the government had conscription, and also the Emancipation Proclamation had been announced. And so all of a sudden, a new reason for the war was the ending of slavery in 1863. And so this was the reason for rioting. The people weren't really willing to fight to end slavery, they said. And also, part of the conscription law was that if you could buy your way out of it for $300, which was more than what the average dock worker in New York City made in a year. And so only the more affluent people could buy their way out of there. And so Fremantle goes on to say, it is their direct interest not only that all slaves should remain slaves, but that the free northern Negroes who compete with them for labor should also be sent south also to be slaves. So Fremantle was saying the average white person in the north not only wanted the southern slaves to remain slaves, because they didn't want them coming up north competing for their jobs. They wanted the small number of free black people who did exist in places like New York City to become slaves also, because they were competing for their jobs, and they wanted a labor market protectionism, essentially. And of course, that was the position of the Republican Party at the outset of the war. It was they wanted no slavery in the territories, because, as Lincoln said, they wanted to keep the territories as an exclusive preserve of free white labor. Those are Lincoln's own words. And so these draft protesters were really just saying the same thing that Lincoln himself said. But since they were protesting the draft, he sent soldiers in to put it down. And so there were these voices, but government always uses violence, murder, and mayhem to quiet those voices. Another book that I mentioned on the chat was Lincoln's Critics, The Copperheads of the North by Frank L. Clement, spelled with a K. And Frank Clement was a historian, and his research during his career was on the Copperheads, so-called Copperheads. Now, the Republican Party called these people were also called Peace Democrats. They were mostly Democrats who wanted peace. They wanted a peaceful end to slavery like all the rest of the world had done, like the British, the French, the Spaniards, the Danes, the Dutch. They all ended slavery peacefully without a war. New Englanders, people in Pennsylvania, New Yorkers, they all ended slavery without a war, but not in the South. And so the Peace Democrats were smeared as Copperheads, which was a rattlesnake or a snake in the grass. And so, and the most famous Copperhead was Congressman Clement Vallandigham from Dayton, Ohio. And Congressman Vallandigham gave many Jeffersonian-sounding speeches on the floor of the House of Representatives opposing Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus and shutting down of opposition newspapers, his imprisonment without due process of tens of thousands of northern citizens for merely voicing opposition to him and his war, and he himself was eventually deported by the Lincoln administration. And so Vallandigham was an important voice of anti-war voice, but look what happened to him. Okay, so I guess that's enough of a discussion about anti-war voices in the Civil War era. And of course, the Anti-Imperialist League, which I put an article or two on, but the article I put on the reading list by Tom Woods talks about the Anti-Imperialist League. And it had some very prominent Americans like Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain were active in this. And so they had a voice, and they tried their best to make known what the U.S. government was up to. Now, when I talked about the government's assault or its campaign of genocide against the Plains Indians in the last class or two, one of the things I don't think I mentioned in my article on it that I put on the syllabus from a couple weeks ago is that Sherman, General Sherman himself, wrote President Grant at the time when Grant was president and said, leave all discussions with the media up to me. If any journalists come out here to the Plains and find out what we're doing, leave it up to me. I'll take care of them. I'll intimidate them. But this was General Sherman, the great intimidator. And so the Army has always made it a point of trying to do its best to keep from the public the atrocities it was committing. And so some of the members of the Anti-Imperialist League, Mark Twain, Andrew Carnegie, and other very prominent people, at least what they tried to do is to reveal these things, is to talk about these things and let people know that these sort of things are not the kind of things your government ought to be doing. And there's a newer book about this that talks about these things that I would recommend. It's called, the title of the book the author is Greg Jones, and the book is Honor in the Dust. The subtitle is Theodore Roosevelt, War in the Philippines, and the Rise and Fall of America's Imperial Dream. And Greg Jones talks about some of these atrocities that were perpetrated against the Filipinos that Mark Twain and others wrote about and tried to bring to the attention of the American public at the time. And here's some of the things he writes about. I'm quoting, burning of houses or entire villages, torture of witnesses or suspects, and in some cases, summary execution of suspected guerrillas were commonplace. Gordon's Scouts, an elite 18th century mounted outfit, was widely feared for its harsh tactics. His favorite interrogation technique was the, quote, water cure, in which a victim was held down, his mouth pried open with a piece of bamboo or a rifle barrel, and dirty or salty water poured down his throat until the stomach swelled to the bursting point, a painful procedure that typically produced quick results. Then Greg Jones is going to talk about the torture of the mayor of a small village in the Philippines who was given the water cure, as it was called. And here's how he describes how this mayor was treated by the U.S. Army, the brave men of the U.S. Army. He was thrown, quote, thrown to the floor beneath a water tank, his mouth forced open and his spigot turned. As water gushed down the Filipino's throat and filled his stomach, an interpreter stood over him ordering, answer, answer. When the mayor was filled with water, soldiers pounded his stomach with their fists. Water spurted from the man's nose and mouth, and the process began anew. The mayor eventually talked, but the American soldiers didn't believe what he told them, so that a second round of the water cure was ordered. His stomach was filled with water again, and a syringe was placed in his nose and more water forced into him. When that also failed to yield the desired answer, salt was thrown in the water can. And then Greg Jones goes on to say, frustrated by their lack of success with the water cure with the mayor, the American military officer in charge then ordered the entire town burned. Torches were lit, and as terrified families fled their houses with the few possessions they could carry, the American soldiers fanned out to start more fires. By midnight, fewer than 20 of the 500 structures in the town remained standing. That's the sort of thing that went on in the American Civil War, the war of genocide against the Plains Indians, the Spanish-American War, and the Filipino insurrection, which came after that, when the Filipinos said, no thanks, we do not want to be a part of the American Empire after just having gotten rid of the Spanish Empire. And that's the sort of thing that happened. And so, in this article of mine that I'm quoting from, the article is from lewrockwell.com. It's entitled Totalitarian Tools. It's about waterboarding. And I quote Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, about waterboarding. He says, quote, "Give me Dick Cheney and waterboarding, and I will get him to confess to the Sharon Tate murders." And so the point being, of course, yeah, you torture somebody like that, they'll say anything eventually. And so even the information you get is not too useful. But that's the American way of doing things under the imperial power of the U.S. Army. And so these are the things that the Anti-Imperialist League tried to bring to the American public's attention. But again, they weren't successful. We did enter, we did have the Spanish-American War, and we did get into World War One, and especially during World War One, with the Sedition Acts, the government passed laws essentially imposing long prison sentences for anyone who would criticize the war, and even some very prominent people were put in prison for reading the Bill of Rights in public and that sort of thing. So whenever the government's imperial powers are genuinely threatened by threatening people like Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie, they become totalitarian beasts. And it's always the totalitarian beast that puts down the opposition and the anti-war movement, the anti-imperialist movement. And it's always under the guise of sweetness and light. We're only doing it to help the poor people in Europe. We're only teaching them democracy, and there's a long list of reasons which we've talked about in this class. And it didn't die out. The anti-war movement did not totally die out. We did have the America First movement prior to World War II, and I think a testament to how important the America First movement was that by 1940, the vast majority of Americans were dead opposed to entering the European War by mid-1940. And that was a big dilemma for Franklin D. Roosevelt. He wanted to get the United States into the war for a lot of reasons, mostly, primarily, in my view, that the New Deal had been a grotesque failure. It made the economy worse rather than better, despite all of his efforts. And so he saw military Keynesianism as the way out. And so there's a book that is relevant here. It's called by Robert Stinnett, and the book is called Day of Deceit. And it's about how Roosevelt connived and plotted and induced the Japanese into attacking Pearl Harbor. And I think I did mention in the course that in the early 90s, President Clinton signed a defense authorization bill that exonerated the two military commanders in Pearl Harbor at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. Kimmel and Short were their names. And it exonerated them because the Americans had long before that intercepted Japanese communication. They had broken the Japanese code, and they knew everything the Japanese were saying. They knew they were coming. They did not share that information with Kimmel and Short. But by the 1990s, miraculously, the government actually admitted this, and they exonerated Kimmel and Short in the Defense Authorization Act, and I believe it was 1992, I think was the actual year of this. It was Bill Clinton that signed it. And so it was a pretty powerful movement. Famous people, again, like Charles Lindbergh, were a part of it. But then, if you recall the article by Randolph Bourne that we talked about, and I asked you to read at the beginning of the course, as Bourne mentions, once the war is started, once the executive branch connivers and plotters get the country into the war, most of the people, most of the public, fall in line. They become like infant children who expect to be protected by their mother and father government, and they believe almost anything the government says. There are wild campaigns to discredit war opponents. And so that was the end of the America First movement. Once the war started, once Roosevelt succeeded in instigating the Japanese into bombing Pearl Harbor, then that was the end. The American public rallied around the war. And the rest is history. I guess since then, we've only had very spotty anti-war movements, like during the 60s, that were shut down also quite effectively by the government. But it's still this, you know, I caught Ron Paul on the Jay Leno show a week or two ago. And when he came onto the stage, Jay Leno's band was playing that old song, War, What Is It Good For? And so you could think of the Ron Paul movement as being the sort of the heirs, today's the contemporary heirs of the anti-imperialist league, the war dissenters during the Civil War, the America First Committee. It's the remnant. It's the remnant of the advocates of peace and prosperity. And as Rothbard said in the article I put on the syllabus and by Mises, that an anti-war and anti-imperialism is a defining characteristic of libertarianism or classical liberalism. Defensive war is one thing, but anyone who calls himself a libertarian has to be against imperialism, because imperialism simply means war, killing, mass murder, debt, taxes, conscription, censorship, totalitarianism at home and imposed in other countries. And how could anybody who is an advocate of freedom be for that? And so so we are the remnant as far as that's concerned. And but don't be too pessimistic over it. There was also a remnant in the old Soviet Union, and they finally collapsed. And so maybe I'll stop there. I just wanted to give sort of an overview of what I saw, some interesting facts that came to mind about this whole tradition of anti-imperialism. And I think the Stromberg article that I put on the Meat Reading List really is a very good article, that a great summary of this whole tradition. And so I'd encourage you to read that if you're so taken about this topic. Okay, and so at this point, I've talked for about 40 minutes. Maybe I'll see if we have any questions or commentary. Joe said he was at an anti-war rally the day the students were killed at Penn State. That'll put an end to the anti-war movement, shooting the protesters. Let's see, any questions? I'll sit here. It's not mandatory. I will, by the way, be making up an exam for anybody who would like a grade for the class. I'll be sending Danny another exam in the next couple of days. And so you'll have the opportunity to get a grade along with your nicely designed certificate from the Mises Institute. Well, Joe Stivaletta sounds almost as old as me. Let's see. Tom Woods' article is pretty good about the anti-imperialist league. Of course, you can look it up on Wikipedia. But you had people like Moorfield Story. Moorfield Story was one of the leaders of the Anti-Imperialist League. He was also the first president of the NAACP in the early 20th century. And so And so I would recommend, you know, read the article I put on the reading list by Tom Woods. And he talked about some of the more prominent members of the anti-imperialist league. And Spomberg talks about some of these people also. Let me see if I can give you some specific examples of who in particular. I mentioned Andrew Carnegie and Mark Twain as being very, very prominent. And of course, there was William Graham Sumner. Well, I just wrote a book, an article about him on LouRockwell.com a couple of days ago, entitled The Man Who Predicted What America Would Become, based on his famous speech, The Conquest of the United States by Spain. And so I have a list here somewhere. Well, among the people in the Anti-Imperialist League, there were businessmen like a Boston textile manufacturer, Edward Atkinson, a former Treasury Secretary, George Boutwell, Mark Twain, Andrew Carnegie, the philosopher William James, a very well-known American philosopher. He was also an activist with this. And so these are some of the big names that were associated with the anti-imperialist league. Well, yeah, as soon as the draft was ended, the war protests ended, and Chris has asked what happened to the anti-war movement from the 60s. Well, yeah, as soon as the draft was ended, that was pretty much the end of that. People were tired of that, and they wanted prosperity. But I think it was revived in the form of the Ron Paul movement, because the so-called neocons, or the war, today's war party, they want war, and nothing but war. And the one thing that the neocons either don't understand or don't want to admit is that war is the biggest destroyer of constitutional liberty, even on the side of the victors, because we always lose a lot of our liberties during wartime, never make them all back up after the war is over. That's called the ratchet effect of the growth of government. And so a lot of the neocons who claim to be constitutionalists and also are warmongers, it's inherently contradictory. They're moving in two opposite directions at the same time. And so and that's why they hated and despised Ron Paul and anybody associated with Ron Paul. Because he was opposed to the foreign policy of invading dozens of countries and conquering and occupying dozens of countries all around the world for benefits that don't seem to be of any use at all for the average American. And after all, Ron Paul was nearly booed off the stage at a convention of evangelical Christians when he said that Jesus Christ is known as the Prince of Peace, and when he commented on this sniper, this American sniper who was murdered himself after he came home from the army, Ron Paul quoted Jesus Christ as saying, "Live by the sword, die by the sword." And he was also booed and ridiculed and horribly by the neocons for quoting such a thing as that. And so it tells you a little bit about the nationalistic hysteria that the neocons have drummed up over the war on the Muslims, Islamo-fascism, as they call it, that they're constantly trying to drum up. And so the modern anti-war movement is mostly the Ron Paul movement. As soon as Barack Obama was elected, all the liberals and Democrats who were talking anti-war shut up. They're all fine with all Obama's wars because Obama is their man. And so that part of the anti-war voice of America disappeared as soon as a Democrat was elected into the White House. Now there's a list that Dan put together, an interesting list of American Imperialist League people. President Grover Cleveland, the philosopher John Dewey, although Dewey later was in favor of World War I. Samuel Gompers, the labor union leader, Henry James, William James, Henry James, Edgar Lee Masters was a famous playwright who wrote the Spoon River Anthology. He also wrote a great biography of Abe Lincoln called Lincoln the Man, which was a harshly critical biography of Abe Lincoln, published in the 1920s, I think, first published in the 1920s. Moorfield Story, as I said, was the founder of the NAACP. Even though he was a white man, he was the founder of the NAACP. Sumner. See if I can recognize some of these other people. Oswald Garrison, Millard, businessman. So that's a good list. Let's see if there's any more questions here or comments. Yeah, 1931, Lincoln the Man. That's a good question. Were there any real protests about the way the Indians were being treated? Not that I've ever ran across. There were individuals. I quote in my article that I put on the syllabus for the core class, there were individuals who wrote letters to the president and to other people who protested, but I don't recall ever reading any mass public protests about what was being done to the Indians. Most of the people didn't know the brutality that was taking place, just as most Northerners had no idea about the brutality of the Civil War, unless, of course, they had a loved one who was killed or maimed in it. But all of that war was fought in the southern states. The only one battle that was fought in the northern state was Gettysburg, and that's really right on the edge, the border of Maryland, and so it's almost in the south, or south of the Mason-Dixon line, just barely north of that. Okay, any more questions or commentary? Why is it that Americans never learn from history? I think one of the reasons is the government has such a big megaphone because it controls higher education through funding, and it controls lower education too. And so there are voices out there that are anti-war and pro-peace, but they tend to be overwhelmed by the government-subsidized voices, and they have been for a long time. I haven't heard this. Bob is asking about the audio recordings by Ralph Rako and Jeffrey Rogers Hummel. I haven't listened to those. I've known Ralph Rako for a long, long time, and I've heard him give many, many speeches on these subjects, so I could probably guess what he said, but I haven't heard that recording. Oh yeah, they're on audiobooks on Mises.org. Oh, it's on Amazon? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Robert Scott notes, James Lucas says that American interventionism caused 20 million deaths. I wouldn't doubt it. Sounds entirely feasible to me, but I'm not familiar. I haven't studied his article. Well, I guess we're pretty much running out of gas. We've got a few comments here. But then I'll just thank everybody for participating in the course. did my best for the first time in teaching this short course on imperialism to expose you to some literature and some of these ideas. And so I hope you learned a few things and will continue learning. Feel free to email me at any time about any questions about anything that I might be able to answer, or suggestions for another course, something like that. And I'd be glad to talk with you about it.